the Growing for Market podcast.
You know, social media is really great, but once you've accumulated like your followers or your likes, the entity that's now hosting you in that social media can now charge you to get access to them. And I saw that before when we first started a long time ago, where we amassed like 20,000 likes. And then it's like, okay, now if you want to post something and you want it to get to those people, you need to now pay for it.
Right. You need to promote the next post to get the same kind of engagement.
The best way to manage that is get your own email list, you know, get the emails yourself. You send the emails yourself, get those emails, and you reach out to customers directly. And that might be hard if you have a lot of customers, but to like, you know, like send them notes. Thank you so much for this, or reach out to them or speak to them and kind of develop that connection. And that would like also kind of help. But that really struck me.
Hello and welcome to the Growing for Market podcast, where we talk about growing, marketing, and the business of growing vegetables and flowers for local markets like farmers markets, CSAs, farm stands, and local wholesaling. I'm Katie Kula, your host and a writer for Growing for Market magazine. For 33 years, the magazine for flower and vegetable market farmers. If you're enjoying the podcast, just wait till you see the magazine. Go to growingformarket.com for more. Also, if you could give us a follow and a rating, it really helps other like-minded people find the podcast. And now let's take a minute to hear from our sponsors. It's with their generous support that we can bring you the podcast for free.
A well-built high tunnel is one of the smartest investments a small farm can make. It protects your crops, extends your season, and keeps income rolling in even through winter. Nifty Hoops builds complete Gothic high tunnels that are easy to install and built to last. Their easy, bolt-together construction makes setup straightforward and efficient, whether it's a small backyard hoop house or a dozen large production-scale high tunnels. Especially through their community build option, where professional builders work alongside your crew, family, or neighbors to build each structure, usually in a single day. Most growers go with Nifty's full setup: steel-framed end walls, roll-up sides, baseboards, double plastic with inflation, automated vents, and real doors, all priced to make the best choice the easy one. Nifty is a small crew out of Michigan using U.S. steel and working hands-on with growers across the country. They'll help evaluate your site, handle NRCS paperwork, and if they're building with you, they'll even float your cost share until after the build. Visit niftyhoops.com to learn more. Farm more seasons. Grow more food. Nifty Hoops.
This is Nathan from Tilth Soil. The other day, I told a friend that I think any product advertised on a podcast is probably a scam. And now I get to eat my words because I really do think it's worth talking to serious growers about living soil. But instead of listening to me bloviate about root development or trace minerals, you're probably better off just trying it out. Go to tilthsoil.com/GFM to request a sample of our seed starting mix and see what your plants think. If you're not impressed, then forget we exist. But if you like what you see, then reach out and we can get into the details. Whether you need a yard, a truckload, or want help organizing a group buy, call or text Josh at 216-870-0642. And yes, I am reading his personal cell phone number in a podcast ad. All right, play the jingle.
I'm in my garden, the sun is shining, my plants are thriving in tilled soil.
Hello, everyone. Today, I am talking with Diane Abushi of Halal Pastures Farm in Rock Tavern, New York. Diane and her husband, Samer, operate Halal Pastures together and sell organic halal meats, eggs, and fruits and vegetables to customers on their farm, through their CSA, and at markets in New York City. They now also ship their halal meats across the United States. The farm also regularly hosts events connecting people with the source of their food and community. Welcome, Diane. I'm so glad to have you here today to talk about Halal Pastures.
Thank you so much for having me, Katie. I know we spoke a few years ago about your book and I've been following you, and we love Growing for Market. We've been learned so much. It was like one of the first magazines we subscribed to. We became farmers, one of the newsletters.
Oh, that's awesome. That's so good to hear. Same with my husband and me. We love it. I'm like, oh, I get to work here now. But yeah, we've been longtime readers. Okay, speaking of beginnings, let's start there. Our audience always likes to hear people's farming stories because they're all so different. So many of us, especially readers at Growing for Market, are not necessarily just walking a traditional farming path. And I know because I talked with you before, yours is also very non-traditional. Can you share how the two of you came to start the farm?
It's a very interesting story. So neither my husband and I come from farming backgrounds. I think we're considered first generation farmers. I am an attorney and he works in finance. And we basically started the farm out of a need to feed our family wholesome food. And the way it started is when we first got married, I was around 6 months pregnant with our first child. And he was reading an article about in Al Jazeera about how Egypt had rejected several tons of corn from the United States. And for him and for us, we're like, why would Egypt reject corn from the United States? And then come to find out it's because it was genetically modified. And that was the first time that we've heard of the term genetic modification. Now, this was back in like 2011 or 2012. So it was a bit of a ways ago. And after we did some research about what genetic modification was, we started to kind of look into our own faith to see what the standard is of food that we're supposed to be eating. And so I know many people are familiar with halal, and halal is one standard, but there's actually a higher standard that's called tayyib, which means wholesome, good, and pure. And this is the food that we're supposed to be eating as humans, as people. And since we couldn't find the food that we needed to feed our family, we started making it ourselves. And we started out primarily first as a meat company, working with local farms, and we still do, to help raise the animals for us. And then we process them halal and sell it. But we've kind of ended up falling in love with farming, and then we started a farm ourselves, and that was a very fascinating curve, and here we are today. So we also farm. We farm vegetables, we do eggs and fruits.
And at the time, you were living in the city, right? So this isn't like two people living in a rural area thinking, let's care about our food. I mean, this is a big lifestyle shift.
Yes, it totally was. It was a big lifestyle shift. I grew up in Brooklyn. And my husband also grew up in a very metropolitan area outside the U.S. He's Egyptian and I'm Palestinian, but was born and raised here. And to go from an area that was like very metropolitan to go to an area that's very rural was very challenging. To have no people around us was very challenging. I'm so used to having neighbors like right next to us. So that was very different. But I've come to really love it because when you live out in the country, I guess you can say, like, you really feel the elements of nature. Like, you really feel the spring, you really feel the fall, you really feel the winter, you really feel the summer. And then I was also introduced to these huge varieties of insects that I didn't know existed in the state of New York. So that also came out. You see foxes out here, you see stink bugs, you see all kinds of bears. There's like all kinds of stuff here that I didn't see growing up.
Do you get fireflies where you are?
I do get fireflies where I am.
That's so magical to me. We don't really have those where I live in the West Coast. So that's like the magical thing other people have. I want to dive into so much, but just to get this out of the way, since it's part of your name and a really important part of your farm story and identity, for those people out there, you've kind of touched on this a little bit, but can you explain what the word halal means for our listeners who might not know what that? And you've mentioned this a little bit already, but like, why is it important for your farm and your business to specifically offer this kind of meat?
Yeah. So halal in Islam basically means something that's permissible. If something is permissible, then it's considered halal. But with respect to meat, it means that the way the animal was slaughtered, how it kind of ended its life. And there's a specific process for that. And you have to also follow the process. It has to be hand slaughtered. You have to recite the name of God and thank God that this animal has been sacrificing its life to feed you. And I think that's very important to for us to find food that is halal, that is slaughtered proper halal ways, because it's out of respect to the animal and out of respect to God. You know, it's just the animal is giving its life for you to sustain yourself, and God created this animal so that you can sustain yourself. And so there needs to be a very humane way of treating this animal, especially towards the end of its life. So for us, it's very important to be following those rules. So for me, so that's why halal pasture started. And then we also wanted the tayyib part, the wholesome part of the meat also, which is why we also look for offer the meat that's 100% grass-fed, grass-finished, and meet the certified organic. Like for us, we feel like that kind of completes the cycle of what we're supposed to be eating. And then you're taking care of the animal up until the time of slaughter. And then the time of slaughter is done very humanely. So the whole process, the whole life of the animal is being taken care of. And so that was very important to me and my husband when we started our farm. Like we specifically wanted food. We wanted to consume animals that were taken care of from A to Z.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me of that Wendell Berry poem. Do you know this one where it's like a prayer and I'll have to look it up and send it to you. It's a pretty famous one, but he's thanking God for this meat. So it's like a grace, but specifically like there's language about for the light and life, the quickness of the eye, and just honoring that this was a living being, you know, who had life force and is now going to sustain his life force. Yeah. I'll have to send it to you later, Diane.
Yeah, I would love to read it.
It's a beautiful little poem. Okay, and so you have this component where you market and organize meat, but you also have your farm. So can you tell us a little bit more about how this business, Halal Pastures, works today? I've watched you grow on Instagram over the years, and it's been cool like to see. It seemed like it started as a small meat business and then expanded to having all these fruits and vegetables. You're now at markets in New York City and shipping. Like, what are you and your husband working on today with all of this?
So I think, you know, we started kind of like in reverse, like we have our meat, we ship our meat, and then we started the farm, and then we started we had like two markets in the city. And then over the years, we've kind of expanded and grown, particularly the vegetable part. It's been like a really wonderful journey. I mean, you hit the nail on the head. So we have markets in New York City. We do CSA. We do ship our meat. People have been asking us to ship our vegetables, but that's a bit challenging. I don't know if we can keep the freshness of the vegetable. It's kind of tough to do.
It's harder than meat, for sure.
It's harder than the meat, for sure. But if it can be done, we'll do it. But, you know, I think right now we have our hands pretty full. We're just kind of serving the New York City area and the farm area. I have a local CSA here also in Orange County, New York, to kind of introduce people to the different varieties that we grow. We tend to grow things that you normally don't see in the supermarket because they're not deemed valuable, because maybe they don't have a good shelf life or you can't grow them for volume. And so we bring back the varieties from around the world and varieties that maybe our ancestors grew up with. And so that's what we have to offer. And so that's what we do.
What are some of those varieties? What are some of the things that you have identified that feel really like important cultural foods or heirloom foods that you weren't seeing offered that you wanted to grow?
Yeah, so there's a lot. Like I try to, you know, like every seed that we pick to grow has a story, right? It has a story behind it. It was meaningful to somebody at some point in time. It was meaningful to a family, or it was meaningful to a culture. It was meaningful to a community. So I'm trying to think of this one variety that we grew last year called the Thelma Sandra squash. And the Thelma Sandra squash came out of a family in the Midwest. It's a winter squash, and it's been in that family for a long time. It's an heirloom seed, and then it became available commercially. And it's like a beautiful, looks like a white acorn. And like, I really love that squash. And this is something that we brought to the markets, and people really loved hearing, called the Thelma Sandra squash. People really love that. I also grow something called Lukhia, which is jute leaf. This is a food that I grew up eating. It's really big in the Middle East. And for me growing up, all I know is what I know as a child of 10, 11 years old. But once I started having the farm and we grew Lukhia, and my family was so excited that we're growing Lukhia, we're growing the jute leaf. And my little mind, I thought, you know, okay, well, I'm Palestinian, so I'm specific to my culture, or, you know, the Egyptians would eat it. But come to find out, it's a global food. And the same thing with fava beans. It's a global food. It's a staple food. So with the Lukhia, you have people in Ghana, you have people in the Philippines, you have people in Bangladesh that have it. The fava beans, it's consumed in South America. It's consumed in India. It's consumed in Europe. It's consumed in Africa. It's consumed in China. It's a staple food item, you know? So for me personally, that was like a wonderful thing to discover. But we do grow like these kind of foods that are meaningful to people and meaningful to different cultures, and kind of bring that back in a fresh, organic way.
When you're at market, do you have customers who just are already like, yes, I see that you have that, I'm so excited. And then do you have other customers you have to educate? And how do you just talk through, or do you do any education through your social media on some of these less familiar, like the squash that you described?
Or like there's a Mexican variety of tomatillo called the Chupon de Malinalco that we fell in love with, that I love so much. It's named after a city in Mexico. And it's like this pointy yellow tomatillo, and it's like, you know, sweet. No, there's a lot of education because people, for example, the tomatillo, people normally see it as like this green vegetable, right? You don't see it as a pointy yellow tomatillo. So there's a lot of education that goes around explaining people the story behind the seed and the story behind the variety. I do that through social media. I do that. I have newsletters that go out. I am at the stand. My staff is at the stand, and we really talk about educating people why this vegetable is good for you to try and to consume, and that there's health benefits to these vegetables. There's a lot of education that happens with halal pastures. Like, there's a lot. And a lot of what we do is very educational based, kind of explaining to people why farmers are important, why the farming is important, why the farming practice is important, why this vegetable is important, why the community is important. There's a lot that goes into it.
Yeah. So I see on your Instagram account that you also host a lot of community events. Can you share more about how you host, what kinds of things you like to highlight, how that's an important part of your farm?
Yeah. So when people tell me they'd want to learn and they want to come tour the farm, usually I do it in groups. I've done this with Cornell Cooperative Extension, a couple of tours that we've done with them. I've done it with local communities. I've done it with the chefs that come through and they want to bring their staff in and kind of educate themselves about farming. So I do host events. I do, you know, it has to be planned in advance. I know it doesn't look like it on Instagram, but it is.
It does look like it. Yeah, your farm's not just open. Let's make that very clear. You can't just show up and say, hey, Diane, give me a tour.
I get that once in a while, you know, if I'm free. But I like to be thoughtful about this. And I like to know, okay, well, the group that's coming, what are they interested in? 9 times out of 10, all the time, they want to be connected to the land. And they want to be connected to the farmer and they want to see how things are done. So a lot of what we do is educate people. Okay, well, this is a high tunnel. This high tunnel is excellent because it allows me to start my farming season early and end it later. It also helps for organic purposes because it helps keep pest management in the sense that it helps keep certain pests out. Mm-hmm. We talk about succession planting and I kind of show them what it is. And so what that does is it brings the vegetable to life, right? It brings the people growing the vegetable also to life because, okay, well, I have this squash, you know, maybe you buy it from a supermarket or you see it. There's more to it. There's a lot that went into producing this one vegetable. And so when people come to the farm and when I host these events, there's a tour, there's talking, there's Q&A, there's tasting, there's them experiencing the farm. And this is just one way of farming, by the way. There's so many different ways of farming all the time, but they come experience our way of farming.
Are you still doing the like farm school summer camp thing you told me about a few years ago?
Yeah, I haven't done it in like 2 years. I want to do it.
Okay.
I want to do it. I'm thinking I want to do it, but it's just been so busy. But I did farm school. I would do it like once a week. I'm thinking about doing it as a 1 week camp because also seeing some of these tours, I do have children come and it's not just all for adults. Like there are kids that come. No, I want to do it because I really love that. Like to see it through the children's eyes, you know, like if we're going to do a bug hunt.
Yeah.
No one's going to go pick like the beetles from the eggplants other than like a 3-year-old, you know?
Yeah, right. No, that's very fun for them. And now let's take a minute to hear from our sponsors. It's with their generous support that we can bring you the podcast for free.
We know it's peak season. You're busy. But the messages you send now are what drive renewals later. That's why Farmhand is offering free, instant access to their farmer-built newsletter builder. No demos, no setup fees, just drop your logo, upload your list, and start sending farm-branded emails that boost sales, engage members, and save you hours each week. Get free access today at farmhand.partners/GFM. That's farmhand.partners/GFM.
And now, back to the show. You are obviously far enough away from New York City that you have a farm, but you're clearly close enough that you can market. And some of these people coming out for your events are coming from the city. So how far away are you? What's that relationship there between your farm and the city at this point?
So the city is also New Jersey. So it's like the tri-state area. So not everyone lives in the city and stuff. So, you know, traffic in New York City is notorious. You know, at 4 a.m. when we get up and go to the markets, 3 a.m., I can get there an hour and change. When the markets are over and it's raining, sometimes it takes me 2-3 hours to come home. But so I think like generally people can expect to drive an hour and a half or so to come to Orange County, where I am.
Okay. So that's New York State, but it's not like upstate New York. You're quite close in. What are the growing conditions and the climate like and the soil like where you are? And how much land do you have at the home farm? I know you work with other farmers for halal pastures, but for your spot?
Yeah, we're in the Hudson Valley.
Okay.
So we're in the Hudson Valley. And in the Hudson Valley, so if you have all of upstate, you have all of New York. There's like further upstate New York that's like by the Canada border. We're further south. And they actually, our climate zone just increased. They just made it warmer. Like, you know, I think we're zone like six, I forgot, is it 6A or 6B, but we've moved up a zone. So we've gotten warmer. Last year we had, it was very warm. This year we're having a very wet season, which is very, it's been a little bit tough. You know, we're farming the black dirt. I'm farming Martin soil and the black dirt. I'm farming about 20 acres there. And it's like flooded, the floods. And so we have all our pumps out, pumping out the water. I mean, I love the water and I love the rain, but it's been a little bit, it's been tough this year so far in that front. Thankfully, we've been able to drain the land.
So do you have drain tiles on the soil? Is that what you mean by draining the land?
No. So we have the water gets on the land and then we drain the water into the main ditch to pumps.
Okay. Okay. I see. I've seen that you have at least several high tunnels. Is that a part of being able to extend your season or is it more for, like you said, the pest management?
Both.
Both.
Both. It's for both. The high tunnels work because it does extend your season, right? So I think the frost here in New York is like May 15th, but I can plant things because of the high tunnels as early as March, right? And if it gets cold in October, because of the high tunnels, I'm able to maybe keep things till the end of November. You know, things like that really help. And then with regard to pets, like a pest, you know, the cucumber beetle, as cute as this little thing is, it's like my nemesis.
Oh my gosh. Do you have the striped or the spotted or both?
Both. And I've spent...
Us too.
I spent the last 10 years of my life trying to manage it. Like, I think I've paid... I read a lot of books and I'm the person that will pay for classes. And I was willing to pay hundreds of dollars on a class to teach me how to deal with this cucumber beetle. Unfortunately, they're a fact of life. You know, they're very difficult to get rid of, especially like once they know you're there. I don't know, man. They must have their own WhatsApp group and send a message to all their cucumber beetles.
Hey, Diane's place is going off, everybody. Let's go.
She's got some squash. She's got some cucumbers. You know?
What crops do they affect for you?
Yeah, squash, cucumbers. Like sometimes I'll find them in the melon tunnel and I'm like, no. But with the cucumbers, this is where the high tunnels come in because you have the mesh. It'll reduce the number that's in there. So you're not going to get rid of them completely, but at least like you'll reduce the number that's in there. And if you see them, you pick them out. You can put those like yellow sticky things that they'll, I don't know if you get, you see one, right? You get those yellow sticky boards that they can go in. You can kind of capture them that way. One year I vacuumed them.
Oh, how well did that work?
I mean, they just keep coming, but one year.
Oh my gosh.
But that's where the high tunnels come in. They kind of like delay that happening.
Yeah. And your farm, as well as the farmers you work for the meat component, you are certified organic as well.
Certified organic, yes.
Okay. And so can you speak to a little bit more? I mean, I feel like you've talked about this, but why that's important to you and how does that inform the choices you're making on the farm? What specifically, what choices and philosophies have you used on the farm?
So we're big believers in the organic and we knew that we would become certified organic one day. So we've always followed organic practices. So it hasn't been different for us. And if that makes sense, like I knew, for example, if I'm going to put up poles, they have to be untreated poles. Like I knew that from 10 years ago, even though we became certified organic, I think a few years ago, but these are practices that we were following anyway, because we consider them like best practices. You know, we bought seeds that were non-GMO or certified organic from trusted seed companies. So for us, it was just a very seamless transition. There hasn't been a change in practice for us. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It sounds like you are really approaching the whole farming and business enterprise with this holistic sense of health.
Trying. It's learning.
What are your favorite seed catalogs? I'm curious. You were talking about all these fun varieties. Where do you find all these fun things that you like to sell?
So, you know, it's funny because like we get a lot of seed catalogs from companies I haven't even purchased from. And so I must be on some kind of mail list. I'm not upset by that because I find some very interesting things. I like Baker's Creek. Mm-hmm. I like Baker's Creek a lot. Hudson Valley Seed Company is nice. I like them. Baker Creek, Hudson Valley Seed Company. Those are key ones. And then if my customers will tell me about varieties that they grew up with or that they really like, that I'll go searching for them and try to find the organic seed for it. So there's that component. Tomato Fest, sometimes I'll find stuff on there. Like, you know, sometimes it's like the small specialty companies that you'll find some good seeds. But I really like Baker's Creek.
Yeah, that's a good one for the less typical stuff. It seems like they have some fun options.
Row 7 is also really nice. We grow some quite a few things. They're a small seed company, but they have some very interesting varieties. We grow quite a few things from Row 7. They have like this really nice, they have the Koginat, which I really like. It's basically a cross between like, it's like a mini pumpkin, but it's like really sweet.
Mm. What is it called again?
Row 7, they have a seed called the Koginat. They're a certified organic company. But yeah, they're also, we get some fair amount of seeds from them too.
I'll have to look into that one. I'm not familiar with it. So your farm is doing a lot of different things today between that, the meat business and now the farming. And you also have eggs, which you're doing on your farm, correct?
Yes.
That you're selling at farmers market through the CSA. How are you balancing all of it? I'm just curious, Dan. And how have you scaled up? Like, do you have a really great management system? Are you using any other helps or outside systems to balance it? And is your husband still also working off farm?
Working off farm, yes.
Yeah. Okay, so that's even more.
It's a lot. In the summertime, it's a lot. It's definitely a lot, and I don't recommend it. But we're always looking for ways to improve and get better. We just changed our point of sale system that I really like.
What are you using now?
I use Square.
Okay.
I like the Square system. I had another system I was using before. Very simple, which is a very nice system, but I needed something that can like, which just had a little more features to it. So I'm constantly looking for like new things to help us manage things in the automated way. As you know, farming is not automated, but certain things maybe you can put on automation, you know, things that would give you reports. We are constantly looking for ways. I found that our system is KISS. Do you know what KISS? Keep it simple, stupid.
Yeah. My dad loves that one. I grew up with that idea.
So the simpler the system, the easier it is to put it into place, especially with our staff and everyone working. Everyone has to be on the same page. So the simpler the system to follow, the easier and the greater chance that it would go into place. Like, I don't like things with too many moving parts. I like things that are very easy and very simple. And I think that's the way it works. So I try to, like Samara and I are constantly thinking about ways to just keep things simple and keep things organized. I think organization is very important in a farm, especially for the organic certificate. Everything has to be, we do a little too much, but everything has to have like, has to be, records have to be kept. So we save everything, we keep everything. I don't know if this is going to be useful one day, but I'm going to hold on to it anyway. But I think keeping organized and keeping things simple, and we're constantly looking for things to make life simple on the farm.
I'm curious, how do you do the record keeping for the organic certification? Because I know some small farmers find that process to feel like it's been designed for larger farmers sometimes, or more like closer to fewer crops kind of farmers in terms of some of the records they ask about, like, when did you plant this? I presume you're planting on like all the time, right? So it's not like I got the corn in on June 1st, right?
So we do that. I do that.
You just keep track of it?
I keep track of everything.
Do you do that on paper or do you have spreadsheets?
Spreadsheets. I do everything as full spreadsheets. I know there's like Google. We use also Google Sheets. I like Excel, but we use Google Sheets. I like Excel because there's a lot more features and I'm more familiar with Excel. I worked at a job a long time ago. I worked in investment banking and they taught us how to use Excel spreadsheets for modeling. And so Sam is very familiar with it, so we like it. But everyone now is using Google Sheets. So that is like, we've had to like mentally shift in that direction. But we keep track of everything. Everything is spread out. The thing is what I'm coming to realize is like, once you have a system in place, then you can just copy and paste it. You know, like if I'm knowing I'm growing this many, growing these variety of seeds, if I'm going to grow 70% of that variety of seeds, okay, then that's going to transfer the next year. And then I can just add the additional seeds that I'm going to be growing and when I'm going to be planting them and when I'm going to be harvesting them and the like.
Do you have a routine of just when you put that information in? Is it, do you have like a morning office routine or an evening office routine of where you keep track of what you did that day? Or maybe you can plan it out all in ahead. We're going to plant salad on all these days. We just, on our farm, it never, we couldn't necessarily, you know, life threw stuff, farm threw stuff at us. So it was often.
So I tried really hard in like the winter time to pre-plan everything.
Okay.
You know, like.
Does it work?
No, it does not work.
Okay. Okay. Maybe.
We tried really hard to like, okay, well, we knew the planting schedule, we've kind of already set that. Like, I know when everything's going to be planted. Like, that's pretty much set unless there's something that's going to come down the pike that maybe we come across or something happens and I need. So that planting schedule, you kind of need to have that planned out soon anyway, because you need to know where everything is going, right? I need to know what high tunnels are being used, what plot of land is being used. So all that has to be pre-planned for it. So I do try to plan and I do try to, you know, put this on paper as much as we can and see if it works.
Is it mostly just adjusting details as you go through the season then? Like, you already have it all spread out and maybe it's a day off, so you just go in and kind of adjust.
Yeah, it gets adjusted pretty often. I need to know how much is going to the market. I need to know how much I'm selling. Yeah. So I need to know that information is very important. So constantly walking the fields, constantly figuring out how much do I have and the weather. You know, that's the other thing, right? Like, I plan to have certain things sooner based on last year's weather, but the weather has been so cold here in New York, I'm having things a little bit later, right?
Yeah.
So this is why the planning, I mean, you just like have an idea of your head of how things can go, but it's like you say, what is the phrase? Like, you plan and then God laughs.
Yes, exactly. Oh man. And I assume that you have help at this point, some employees who are, what level of scale of help do you have? You have people working in the fields at market. How are you organizing that?
Both. I have both. We have staff that helps us on the farm, experienced staff, and I have staff at the market that helps us. I can't be in two places at once. But that's also why you have to keep everything simple, right? So everyone's on the same page. It really has to be simple.
Yeah.
So that everyone's following like a very simple system. Like, I was just organizing how we're going to bring everything down to market. I was just having this conversation with Samer and the best way to organize it. Because I do have a lot of markets. Okay, well, how much tables do I have? Can I make sure this market has the tables that it needs? And then make sure that they have the right price signs and have my banners and have like the weights and have like the bungee cords and have the tents and have like these, all these moving parts. So of course, what do? We have a chart and the chart has, okay, well, this market should take this. This market should take that. This market has this, blah, 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 blah. Every little detail that goes in. Okay, well, now that's amazing. We have this very fancy chart down to the person that's going to, you know, institute this chart. Like, is it working? Well, we're going to give it a try and see how it works. So far it's been working. A little hiccups, but.
Yeah. How many markets are you at this point? I was looking at the website. It looked like a lot.
We have around 11 markets now.
That is a lot.
That is a lot.
That is a lot of markets.
Some
markets. You definitely need help.
I don't.
That's more days than, or markets than days in the week. So.
Oh, we have a lot of vegetables that I'm trying to, you know, we have to sell.
Yeah. And then you also have your CSA. It sounds like that's mostly for your local customers.
So certain markets also have a CSA attached to it. So I have a CSA New Jersey, CSA Jersey. I have CSAs in New York City. We did a lot of advertisement this year for CSA. So we got like a kind of, okay, we got a good turnout. Like, I'm happy with it. Alhamdulillah. And hopefully that will grow with that. So we're trying to like grow the CSA component. The more vegetables that people get to eat, the more organic vegetables, the better it is. You know, the more you're supporting local, the money staying within the economy, you know, staying locally, is like, these things are good. And then I get some great comments. Like, one of the CSA members yesterday sent us a message on Instagram. He said, he made this, just, you know, it's a family person, not, you know, he has kids, he has a family. He writes, my daughter who isn't keen on vegetables cleared her plate except for the beets, but she loved it. Grateful for your hard work.
Oh, that is the best.
It's just like, makes me so happy, right? It's like, I get these comments a lot. Oh, my kids don't like X, but they devour, you know, your vegetable. My daughter doesn't like tomatoes, but they always say they'll only eat Diane's tomatoes, you know? So it's like, these comments just make me so happy. It just, it's motivating, keeps you, it just wants you to keep going.
Yeah, I think that's the best. I think that's what all the farmers, well, it's one of the main motivators anyway, is that connection. It's beautiful.
Yeah, so we try to maintain that connection.
And speaking of connections, so in addition to just connecting on Instagram, we also connected because I interviewed you for my book, about farming and parenting. And I know from talking to you then, I mean, this is part of why I reached out to you, but also in that conversation, it sounds like being a farming family was a really important value for you and Sammer.
Yes.
And can you just share more about that relationship between your family life and the farm and the children and kind of how you've worked to integrate all of that and what your motivations are there?
So that's a really good question. It's a work in progress. That's how I like to think about our lives. It's just a learning journey, and you have to kind of roll with the punches. And wherever you are at that point in time, you just have to work with that point of time that you're in. So the farm is a big part of my children's experience. Like I'll take them to markets with me. I try to take them to the markets. There's a couple of markets that have a park. So we go to the market, you know, the park literally is like right next to our farm stand. So I'll take them to that, you know, I'll give them money. They'll walk around the farmer's market. They'll interact with the other farmers or the other producers. They'll buy stuff. They'll eat stuff. And then they'll come to the stand. They'll help us stock the stand, help keep everything fresh, keep everything clean. And then they'll get the chance to talk to the customers about like our vegetables or our farming practices. And then I'll teach them, okay, well, you know, this person paid $5 for, I don't know, bok choy. So they gave you, it cost $5. They gave you $10. How much do you get back? Like I tried to kind of incorporate a little bit of that in there. At the farm, you know, I try to have them be involved in like the planting or the harvesting. We walk around and we kind of talk about what's happening at the farm, so that they're involved, because that is the focus, right? It's like, you know, you want your kids to be, grow up to be good humans and to be productive people and be productive members of society. And I know that we feel that the farm will allow them to get to that point, and also teach them the value of hard work and the value of the land and the value of the earth and the value of the soil and the value of community. There's so much that comes with it. So as much as we can, we really try hard to incorporate them in what we're doing.
And how do you balance farming versus parenting? Because it sounds like both you and Sam are very involved in the farm. And he also has off-farm work. And then you also have three kids at home. Like, what does that look like for you? Are you hopping in and out of the fields and the house? Or
they're with me all the time.
How do you do that?
They're with us all the time.
They're just with you all the time. Okay.
I don't know how else to do it. Like they're with us all the time. I feel, you know, I wish I can give them 100% attention, but if I incorporate them into what I'm doing, then I'm giving them some kind of attention. I try to read to them. I try to like give them that one-on-one time, but I think the easiest way to do this is to have them actually incorporated into the work that we do. That's just, they're learning and they're connecting. And then we have something to talk about. Like, I don't know how else to do it. And this craziness only applies basically in the spring, summer, and early fall. Then it just kind of gets cold and things kind of slow down a little bit. A lot of the markets end, you know, they're seasonal markets. They're short time. So they'll end by like November. And then we can be normal parents. But for right now, I don't know. I don't think I have a balance. I think some days they get more attention. Some days it's less attention. Sometimes the farm gets more attention. Sometimes it's less attention. Like I think you have to just do the best that you can.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that is always true. I mean, parenting, that's just parenting right there, right? You do the best you can. So.
And the kids are healthy. They're growing healthy. They're respectful. They're learning how to read. I put them in an online program. They can't wait for me to teach them. Like I put them in a little bit of an online program so that they can learn some reading and things like that to keep things going until I'm able to do more. We just have to make it work.
Yeah. I'm sure they're eating the best food.
That? Yeah, they're very picky about their food. I mean, they know their varieties. They'll know. So, I mean, that beautiful byproduct of having the farm. My kids know their food.
Yeah.
They know their food. They know their varieties. They know how to grow it. My son took a bunch of extra tomato plants that I had and planted them right by. They have a small garden by the house for him, and he's managing it. And he came in this morning, Mama, I have 7 tomatoes that's growing, you know, and he like pruned them. And then he's like, Mama, you know, I'm going to take out the suckers when they get a little bit bigger, you know? And he was asking me about like to trellis them. He's like, oh, you know, I'm going to go find old wood around the farm and then use it to like, you know, whatever broken stuff that we have. And he can use it to just trellis the plant. I mean, that's priceless, right? Like he's knowing how to grow his food.
Oh yeah.
And he knows about it. He knows a tomato plant. How many 7-year-olds you know about a tomato plant?
Probably just the ones growing up on a farm or with a family that garden. Yeah.
Yeah. Or farm does. Yeah. And that's they're doing fine.
Yeah. No, that's great. I mean, we need that for the future. And speaking of the future, as you look ahead to your long-term plans and vision for Halal Pastures, I'm curious what kind of long-term challenges you might be anticipating and what kind of steps are you taking to meet those?
Long-term challenges. You know, sometimes I wonder about markets and I wonder, you know, are they still going to be around? You know, so much of your, if your business is really dependent on markets and something happens to the markets, what does that mean for you? So that's something that we think about. I think about the weather. Like they say, when the weather's really good, you have one good season, it'll carry you for seasons. When the weather is bad, what do you do with that? I think it's important the way you to manage these things. Also, you know, the meat, getting certified organic grass-fed beef in the United States is hard to find. And a lot of farmers these days are choosing to not certify their beef as organic, as I've come to find, but they're certifying their grass as organic. So there's that kind of a, what does this mean for how we want to do this? We're committed to local, you know, now you can probably get grass-fed beef overseas at a fraction of the price here that you would get in the United States, unfortunately. But so these are some of the things that we think about, what would this mean for us? And I think part of what we think about managing is to just diversify. Don't put all your eggs in one basket as much as you can. That's why like CSAs are good. You know, that's one outlet, right? If a CSA doesn't do well, well, you have a market. Well, if the market doesn't do well, maybe you can open up a wholesale account. If the wholesale doesn't do account, maybe you can open up another retail. Let's just try to diversify, I think.
Yeah, I think that's a really common approach for our audience of farmers for the magazine, which is part of why we like to interview lots of different kinds of farmers, you know, get people ideas, like what's the next thing they could try or add to their diversity of offerings.
Yeah, like, I don't know, we're constantly thinking about ways to sell the product and different avenues for the product. I think it would be helpful for farmers to kind of have like brainstorming sessions, you know, like business brainstorming sessions, like let's everyone get in the room and figure out what's the best way to handle this issue or the best way to sell this product, right? Or get it to consumers. How can you hedge your losses or how can you, or create another market? How can you advertise? You know, these things I think are important. Like years ago before COVID, I read all these books on marketing. I picked like the top five books that were like on the New York Times bestseller list or like various marketing lists. Like, you know, this is the best, this is how you do like proper marketing and this is how you do proper advertising and this is what you should say and what you should do, but to kind of just be educated as much as you can. And, you know, now we have like a lot of, you know, everyone's on social media, you know, which is another avenue to market.
Mm-hmm. Was there any really useful information from those books that you found or anything you would recommend anybody read?
One thing I read in a book, and this was like a while back and it stuck with me because it turned out to be true. You know, social media is really great, but once you've accumulated like your followers or your likes, the entity that's now hosting you in that social media can now charge you to get access to them. And I saw that before when we first started a long time ago, where we amassed like 20,000 likes. And then it's like, okay, now if you want to post, you're going to post something and you want it to get to those people, you need to now pay for it. Right?
Right. You need to promote the next post.
You need to promote
to get the same kind of engagement.
To get the same kind of engagement. And what this book was saying is that the best way to manage that is get your own email list. You know, get the emails yourself. You send the emails yourself. Get those emails. And he was also saying to reach out to customers directly. And that might be hard if you have a lot of customers, but to like, you know, like send them notes. Like, thank you so much for this. Or reach out to them or speak to them and kind of develop that connection. And that would like also kind of help. But that really struck me.
So have you built an email list from your social media base? And how do you get people to make that leap? Or do you collect emails at market? And which way do you go?
I try to collect as many emails as I can. I really do.
Just everywhere.
Yeah. Hey, you want to connect with Halal Pastures?
Give me your email address.
Give me your email address.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you should try to connect as much as you try to collect it. Like, try to be independent. This is my humble advice. That connection that you have with the consumer, try to make as much as you can, make it meaningful and make it direct. You know, when the email comes from your farm directly, I think is impactful. You make those is interesting. And not everyone's going to open up the email, you know?
No. They might. Yeah.
You know, social media is great and it's a great platform to support your business, but you never know what's going to happen with these companies. And you never know, like, things are changing so fast and maybe AI will take over and all this will be obsolete and there'll be like a new media platform. And then, okay, well, what about all those people that you've like worked so hard to develop the, I mean, you saw that with TikTok, right? Early on in the year.
Yeah. When it was down for a day.
It was down for a day and then they're like, oh, we're going to ban TikTok. I mean, we don't have a heavy presence on TikTok. So, but that illustrated the point of this gentleman in the book that now I have to find that book. I'll find it. I'll let it, you know.
Okay.
But it was really sound advice. And this is advice. I think this book was written in like 2017 or 2016. It's still relevant to today.
Yeah. So prescient. Yeah. No, I think I've seen that advice too. Because it's true, if you own your email list, I mean, you could use that on MailChimp, you could use it on Squarespace emails, you can, but the emails are yours.
Yes.
When you have them in the email list, which is very different than the relationship you have on social media. It's not, those connections belong to the social media company.
Belong to the
they can do whatever they want with your account, basically. I've seen people get very upset about that, you know, like, oh, they changed the algorithms. And I'm like, yeah, it's their product. We're on there for free. This is the flip side of the coin of this free app is it's theirs.
I mean, it's great, right? Like you do an ad or you do a post, it can go viral. We've done a couple of videos that have gone viral. I don't know what the recipe was for it to go viral.
Yeah, we all want to know that recipe.
I don't know why one post would do better than the other, right? So sometimes, okay, some certain things will go viral and you know, you get the benefit of that publicity and other things like you work so hard at and you're like, oh my God, only 10 people looked at my story.
Yeah.
We're like 100 people only looked at my video. But yeah, it's a funny thing, social media. I don't know the algorithm, how that really works. But I think to collect emails, back to the point, to the extent that you can collect emails, I know now people, I don't do this, but people do text message advertisement. Like there's like, now you can sign up for, I signed up for a company called Constant Contact that I like, and they have an option to do like text messaging. There's a lot that you could do with the marketing out there. It's like a full-time job.
So in the category of like giving advice, since our audience is mostly direct market farmers or people who want to be direct market farmers, I'm always curious to ask about if people, any of my guests have any kind of tips or tricks that we can share with each other. Basically, I like to ask people like, it's kind of an impossible question to answer because I know we all have lots of these things, but what is one best thing that you and your farm team or and Sammer have done for your farm so far that you just are like, other people should try this or do this?
Other people should try and do this. From a farm, from like a marketing perspective?
No, from anything. Just anything on your farm. It could be a tool. It could be a decision you made. It could be anything. You know, what's just a really positive thing?
Positive thing. Oh, that's a great question. I feel like we're constantly changing things for the better. Two things. One, I think it's important to be forgiving of yourself and the people you work with. I think having that attitude is just very, it's like, it's a game changer. And I think working with people's strengths is very important. I think whoever you're with, like optimize what their strength is. So if they're not organized, right, but they're really great at, I don't know, numbers, then let them be the numbers person. Or if, you know, they may not be good with harvesting, but they might be like excellent planters. Or maybe this person is not very social in the market and doesn't like talking to people, but they're very good about making the stand look nice. So one thing is to say, I think work with people's strengths. I think that's really important, you know, and giving second chances, all that is really important. And then the second thing I would say is we made value added items last year. You know, we made like pickles and we made like jams, and I was really excited about that. That was fun. So I think if you can make some value added items out of your products, I know a lot of farmers do. I think that that was good. And we got like a really nice reception from that at the market. People really liked our value added items and I was able to ship it. I'm actually shipping my tomato sauce right now.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Halal Pastures heirloom tomato sauce. So that's pretty cool. I'd be like, oh, look, my label's on this product, the vegetable that I grew.
Nice. Those are great. Is there anything else you'd like to share with our audience about your farm, your experience, the business?
No, I learned so much from Growing for Market. Like I really do. Like I really read those articles and listen to the podcasts and hear people's experiences and hear what they have to say. I think farmers have a wealth of knowledge in terms of like what you should do or you shouldn't do and how like approach this. And it's been really nice kind of learning from others and hearing other people's experiences and seeing like where we can match that energy at our own farm. It's been really great. Like, I really like you guys. Thank you.
Hey, I'm glad to hear that. Now I'm like part of the magazine, but like I said at the beginning, I genuinely love this magazine too. As just a reader and farmer, it's so great to hear from other farmers.
I saved all your magazines and I gave them to someone that wanted to start a farm. I'm like, here, read this.
Oh, perfect. Perfect. Oh, I love that. If people want to find out more or maybe even buy your meat or find you at market, what's the best way for them to connect and find you?
So we are, you know, if you call the 1-800 number, you will reach Samer. We do answer all the
questions. Okay. If anyone wants to chat with Diane and Samer, now you know.
Plus, we are the ones that get the emails. You know, you can message me on social media, on Instagram.
Okay. And what's your handle there?
At Halal Pastures Farm. Or you can email us at info@halalpastures.com. And then we can always get in touch if there's any way we could be helpful or of use, you know, or as a resource. Please count us as a resource. I know all farmers are in this together. I'm happy to help in any which way we can.
And the website also has your online store for ordering meat, it looks like, too.
Yeah, if you want to order meat, you can go to halalpastures.com. If you are organic grass-fed farmer and you wanted to work with us, give us a call.
Yes, there you go. Okay. Well, Diane, it was such a pleasure chatting with you again and hearing more about other parts of your farm and operation and watching you grow over the years. It's been great. Thank you so much for sharing some of your valuable time with our audience
today. Thank you for having me.
You are representing the whole farm. Thank you, Diane.
You're welcome.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Growing for Market podcast. If you've been enjoying the show, please consider giving us a follow and a rating or a review. It really helps others find the podcast. For more tips and information from farmer to farmer, check out our magazine at growingformarket.com. Whether you're a commercial grower or just want to grow like one, subscribe to Growing for Market magazine for the nitty-gritty of growing, marketing, and the business of market farming. We publish 10 issues per year with articles written by experienced farmers on topics ranging from tools and techniques to farm business operations and marketing. If you've been listening to the Growing for Market podcast and you haven't yet checked out Growing for Market magazine, we've made a change so you can try the magazine for free. We've added a free month to the beginning of all first-time subscriptions. Try out the digital or paper magazine, and if it's not for you, cancel within 28 days and you'll never get billed. With digital subscriptions starting at just $39 per year, you get a year of the magazine, plus over 150 back issues from the last 15 years. Head on over to growingformarket.com and subscribe today to benefit from over three decades of writing by farmers, for farmers, and Growing for Market magazine.